The next matter on for oral argument, Toyota Lift of Minnesota versus Julich and others. Deja vu. I'll remind you of our rules. Each side will have 15 minutes to present your argument with an additional 5 for appellant's counsel if you choose to use that time for rebuttal. Please state your name as you commence each segment of your argument, and do be mindful of the timing restrictions which are indicated in the podium by a light and a clock. Also, you've been here enough. Just on this case, you know that there's a button in front of the podium that allows it to raise and lower, so I don't have to remind you of that. But counsel for appellant, whenever you're ready to proceed, you have the floor.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honors, may it please the court, my name is Paul Chamberlain. I represent Toyota Lift of Minnesota, and our appeal is of the $54,000 judgment that was entered in Hennepin County District Court. By way of background, we think that the main issue here is that there was a final judgment when we were here last time, that we had a claim that we were defending for fees. The trial court had ordered $237,000 of fees and costs, and it was affirmed on appeal. And that included everything that we thought could be brought against Toyota Lift. There was no motion made within the 15 days of Rule 139.06 of the Civil Appellate Rules that would allow fees and appeal. And we got a final judgment on October 15. We paid it with the cost and everything we thought we were done.
Let me ask you a question about that. I understand that Rule 139.06 requires that fee requests on appeal be made to this court and within the time frames that you've identified.
Yes, sir.
Is it your argument? I think it is your argument that the prevailing appellant in, I don't know if we'd call that the second or the third, the last appeal, the one preceding this one, the appellant in that case didn't request any fees on appeal, but that the appellant should have requested that this court determine the reasonable fees in the district court? Is that your argument?
I think
that wasn't a very good question.
Let me see if I can make sure I understand it, Your Honor. The trial court found that there were $39,000 of fees that were spent on the appeal of the $237,000 judgment.
Right.
We said to the trial court that you can't consider that.
Just the 39 is what you were talking about.
That's all I'm talking about now.
All right.
And then that 139 could not be considered, and the trial court agreed, said that as I read the rule, it says shall bring it, that must be brought to the appellate court. In fact, in the Kalar case, I think I got the right name on that, it said that the trial court doesn't really have the ability or the duty to, or the responsibility to generate an order based on fees on appeal. That was in Judge Lancaster's judgment in that case, and that was our reason why we thought that those appeal fees, that $39,000, were not appropriate, and the trial court agreed. The next point was that they had failed to preserve that they had a right to more fees, and this is a case where we talked about it being an ancillary proceeding, but we already went through that. We already had a separate proceeding for fees claimed in the case of $217,000, which we thought was a lot, and now they're saying there's $100,000 more. But we've been through all that. That had been through appeal, and it was done. And so you can't go back and say, well, I should have brought some more fees that I had between the time that I filed my petition and the time of oral argument. They said there were some $54,000 of fees in that time without ever delineating what they are. And in page 33 of the transcript, counsel said, well, I knew that we had more fees, but I figured there'd be a second hearing. I didn't want to gum up the works, and so I just left it alone, and that's what I did. So it wasn't that they didn't know, and it wasn't that they weren't aware of it. They just didn't do it, and they had to do that. They had to have said to the court when it was making the oral argument back in October of 2017, I need to supplement my fee petition. I need to add on another $54,000. It would have been more. They were claiming bankruptcy fees and things like that. But if they're going to add any more on, they've got to do it so that when the trial judge gets it and issues a judgment, it's a judgment of everything. It's not a piecemeal appeal. It's a thing that is done where you've got a complete decision. In fact, in our statement of the case, that we were asked, is this resolving all issues in the case, including attorney's fees? And we said, yes. Respondent didn't file a statement of the case. And
in the earlier appeal.
In this appeal.
This appeal.
Yes. So if, as far as we're concerned, there was a definite failure to preserve it, and we should not be vexed twice with the same claim for the same thing. I'd like to address a couple other points here, too, that had come up. One was there were two other proceedings that were involved here. There's a bankruptcy proceeding where the U.S. trustee had sued the respondents for some $387,000 of fraudulent transfers. And that when that case was pending, we had some interaction with the trustee and Julek's lawyer, which was not counsel here. And we made the point that they should use the judgment that Julek got and Tomke got to pay for the settlement, because they'd claimed they didn't make any answer in the $387,000 suit. They said, we're impoverished, we don't have anything. And the trustee agreed. They said, okay, but you got to confess judgment that you get the full judgment. If we find out that either you transferred assets or you have some, we get to take them, and we get an automatic judgment by affidavit less what's paid. The only issue in a bankruptcy from our standpoint was, why don't you use the judgment that they have against Toyota Lift to help pay the settlement to the U.S. trustee?
Your argument is that pertained mostly to the judgment that we're not concerned with here, the judgment that Toyota Lift had against the salespeople.
That's right, and to the bankruptcy proceedings, that it cannot be. They weren't even representing these people in bankruptcy. They say they were considering what the effects were, and they were claiming that we were trying to collaterally attack the judgment by using that judgment to pay for the trustees' argument. And that isn't collateral attack at all, nor could it be. I mean, the bankruptcy court can't do that kind of thing. The other thing that occurred was that we had a fraud lawsuit against the second one we brought before Judge in Hennepin County District Court. Judge Mary Vasily was the trial judge. It was for $1.3 million of a nondisclosed order that was in part of the negotiation. That was also disposed of as part of the global settlement, and everything was resolved at that time that we got done. The point that we've made on the Lodestar argument is significant. It's up to the claimant to show what your fees are. In this case here, on page 7 of the transcript, Mr. Dreyer said, I've got a spreadsheet that shows how it is, but I forgot it. I didn't bring it to the office.
Did that ever make its way into the record?
Never. I never saw it.
I looked for it. I couldn't find it.
I'm sure it's not there. I know I've never seen it myself. And the only thing in the record is a statement on page 7 saying, I left it back at the office, and I don't have it. So what happened at the hearing on this case is that there was a representation saying it's $39,000, which we couldn't verify, but...
And Mr. Chamberlain, with that in mind, if the panel believes that the district court did have jurisdiction over at least the fees that were incurred in front of the district court, and that their post-file motion in that regard was timely, but given what your arguments on the Lodestar and the kind of just excessive nature of the fees from your perspective, is there a basis we have just to say, you know, we're reversing the, I think it was $54,000 award, and that's the end of it, as opposed to what, you know, would appear more likely that, okay, we just need to remand this back to the district court if we buy those arguments.
Okay, if you...
And I'm sorry if that was too tangential a question. I'm happy to repeat it.
No, I think I understand the point, Your Honor. If I don't, I hope you follow up. But the argument that in order to get to that question, you have to obviously ignore the fact that there's a final judgment in the appeal.
And I'm asking you to do that.
And I'm doing that.
Question.
And I'm saying now we get to the question of a Lodestar. Then it's the question of what for. $54,000 is a lot of money. It's got to be delineated. And they say that we spent it on preparing the fee petition last time and for garnishment that they did, because the day that we were circulating the settlement and it was payday and Friday, they garnished the bank account of their former employer and for some amount of money.
So why wouldn't we be affirming for at least the amounts that are on Exhibit A for an example.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
On the amounts listed on Exhibit A, I think it was. There was some chart, I believe.
Yes, it was designated as an Exhibit A, and I can't remember what it was attached to. It was a long listing of their legal expenses, item by item, date by date.
So the question is, why wouldn't we affirm on those amounts?
Because those amounts are, I'm just looking at it as someone, former lawyer from private practice, and said, okay, it looks like, you know, an account of my time.
Okay, but it was counsel's delineation of blended time with no real allocation in the time. They were block items that were including everything. And in order to come to the conclusion that there was $54,000 of fees, that was done as a residual. The court said, well, of the $100,000, I can't give you $39,000 because that's in the appeals court. I can't give you the $7,000, that's in bankruptcy. And if you reduce those two from the 100, you end up with 54, and they say that's what you get. That's not the way to do it.
So what's the remedy? Why would the remedy be for us to remand to the district court to parse it out rather than simply reverse it?
The remedy, I think, on that case, assuming the worst, that we lose on our other points,
right,
there,
sure,
that would be a remand because it simply isn't done. It does trouble me to say that, though, because there is the duty of the respondent and someone applying for fees in a case that's lasted this long to put everything you have in front of there. And in page 33, it says, we're planning to come back later for another hearing after the appeal. And I had already told him that. And I said, well, you know, I didn't know that. I mean, no one said that before the $217,000 judgment or $237,000 with costs. So we're really stuck. Now, I really request that that be rejected for failure of proof as opposed to saying you get a second chance to prove it. I think in most other situations, if I come to the court and I don't have proof and it's inadequate and then there's a decision saying it is inadequate, I cannot appeal and say, well, let me have another chance.
So I just want to make sure I understand. Are you saying then, I mean, because earlier I thought I heard you say, okay, if we do not buy your arguments on the jurisdiction and the timeliness issue and on this $54,000, earlier I thought you said, well, yeah, you got to probably remand it. Now you're saying, well, they haven't met a threshold barrier, a barrier of proof. So we don't have to remand? I just want to understand your position.
I apologize. It seems to me, as I further thought of it, because I never thought of it until you asked me the question, that the ability to get a remand and a second chance on that should not be done, and it should be reversed and taken away for failure to prove. Then a remand would then say, well, you didn't do it right, and you didn't put it in the record, so why don't we send it back and do it again? That shouldn't be the way the appellate court works. If there's any other case that you have, let's say it's no matter what it is, I failed to put the contract in, remand it so I can put it in. I think you'd say, no, you don't get to do that. You know, you have your opportunity at the trial court level, and if you either do it completely or you don't. And if you don't, you don't get to come back and say, well, I'd like to do it again. So I apologize for suggesting that a remand would be appropriate. I don't think it would be.
Well, in a sense, they did put the evidence in, though. They did put it in. They put it in combined with an amalgam of other fees from the bankruptcy case and on appeal and what have you, but they put in well over the $54,000. They proved it. They put in evidence of well over that amount.
They put in blended evidence that totaled $100,000,
right,
for many different things without delineating what they were for. They didn't even have the appeals fees broken down. That was just something that he said.
Right. I understand what you're arguing, but I'm saying, my question is, it isn't a case where there's a complete lack of proof by the party seeking fees. There is proof. It's just that the proof didn't identify which file, which proceeding, which venue each item of fees related to.
Which, Your Honor, is my point, that if you have it blended all together with improper claims throughout and you don't know which ones they are, the obligation of a person proving fees is to say, I did this for this purpose here, not saying, I got $100,000 here, so you figure it out. And then, or say, it must be the residue if you take out the appeals fees, which they couldn't have, and the bankruptcy fees, disregarding the other civil action, and then say, it's all the rest. Because for all the rest, $54,000 to file a garnishment on our client's bank account, or to have the work that was done between the presentation of the petition in May and the oral argument in October, you know, that's completely improper not to have that in there to supplement the record, because it leaves us from a defending standpoint is we don't know what we're getting. And to say, yeah, you proved $100,000 in fees, but we don't know what it's for, it was up to them to show what it was for, because that's the only thing they could have claimed. And there's no way you can read that and say, I can see what it's for and I know that it's appropriate. We also contend, as we've argued in our brief, that the amount of $54,000 is an absurd figure for what the claim was done. The case is all done. They already filed their petition, and they're saying that $54,000 was spent in there for what has not been delineated. In that case there, that should not be accepted or remanded. I see I'm out of time.
You are, and you will have 5 minutes of rebuttal.
Thank you,
Your
Honor.
Respondent.
Thank you, Your Honors. Counsel, may please the court. My name is Ryan Dreyer, and I'm here representing the respondents, Mark Julek and Steve Tomke. We're asking that this court affirm in part and reverse in part the district court's award of attorney's fees for three reasons. First, the district court did have jurisdiction to consider the second fee petition. Secondly, the district court did not clearly err in relying on the evidence in Exhibit A to the time entry or to my declaration, which included all the time entries that fully supports the district court's decision. And three, we think the district court should be reversed because it misapplied Section 181.171 when it did not allow us to have the attorney's fees from the appeal, the first or the second round of appeals in this case. First, we'll hit the jurisdictional issue. The district court clearly had jurisdiction to consider the second fee petition, which included attorney's fees prior to the second round of appeals in this case, and for the attorney's fees after the second round of appeals in this case. Two authorities on that. One is Keller v. Von Holtum, where the Supreme Court clearly ruled that district courts maintain jurisdiction to consider fee applications for fees incurred prior to previous appeals. That decision was affirmed by this court in Rooney v. Rooney in 2010, and I think the quote from that case is dispositive of the issue. Quote, in other words, Kellar does not forbid a district court from awarding attorney's fees that were incurred in the district court before previous appeals. That's exactly the situation we have here. That's exactly what the appellant's argument is that the district court did not have jurisdiction to consider the second fee petition in so much as it contained fees from prior to the second round of appeals in this case. Those cases are dispositive of the issue. The second issue I want to talk about is whether or not the district court erred in relying on the evidence that was before it in the second fee petition.
Did it err in relying on evidence that wasn't before it in terms of counsel's representation of the breakdown?
No, actually that evidence was before the district court.
Where do I find it in the record?
You would find it at page 8 of the appellant's response to our motion. I believe it was filed on November 8th, 2018. And what I'm talking about there is their memorandum of law in opposition to our second fee petition. Page 8 of that memorandum of law, TLM, Toyota Lift, itemizes the entries from our attorney.
What's the date of that? I'm not going to be able to find it right now. I'll go back and
November 8th, 2018.
Okay.
And in that memorandum on page 8, they itemize the time entries that they object to. They say, hey, these are from the bankruptcy case. These are not from the state court action, this action that we're in today. Judge, you shouldn't award those fees. So they pick out every one of the transactions that they object to. They itemize them on page 8, and they have the date of the entry. They have the timekeeper of the entry. They have the number of hours of the entry, and they have the dollar value of the entry, and they say, Judge, we object to these.
How is that evidence, how is that objection evidence, affirmative evidence, by on your client's behalf, meeting your client's burden to establish that the work was incurred in the district court proceedings pursuant to collection of defendant's judgment award through garnishment and general representation? Et cetera, as found by the district court.
So those entries that I'm talking about are actually itemized in their memorandum of law, but they come from Exhibit A to my declaration on November 1st, 2018, and that's the attorney fee printout from our law firm's accounting records that show itemized all the time entries that we were asking the court to award us. So those time entries are all in there, and they explain what they're for, and then combined with my declaration, which says that, hey, we've reviewed these, we filter out the entries that are not for collection or protection of the judgments, the rest of these are, and we are asking for, you know, just over $100,000 of fees. So the evidence...
And your, if I understand your response, the evidence would necessarily have to include counsel's representation, not in order to reach the dollar amount the district court found.
No, it wouldn't. It's just simple math, right? If you go to page 8 of their memorandum of law from November 8th, 2018, they identify all the time entries that they object to. They just didn't add them up. I added them up on that spreadsheet that I didn't bring with me to court, but I knew the number, and I actually had it on my iPad at court, and I pulled it up during the interim when they were arguing.
Why didn't you print it out and mark it as an exhibit?
Well, because the time entries themselves are already in the record, and the court can do the math. I did the math. They didn't do the math. They can't really object to the arithmetic, right? The arithmetic is the arithmetic.
The problem is the district court didn't do the math in awarding the amount. The district court didn't explain how many hours it took at what rate of pay, which it found to be reasonable, to arrive at the $54,000 number. It just didn't do that.
Correct, and that's part of the analysis. I mean, I'm not saying it correct. The district court didn't do that analysis. The district court... It doesn't show from the district court's decision that it added those numbers up, but I added them up before this appeal. It's right. The exact number the district court...
But even if the number's right...
Right. Even if that works out, how does that comply with the requirement that the district court figure out the reasonable number of actual hours spent, the reasonable rate of pay, and the lodestar mechanism?
Well, the district court did do that, and one of the things the district court can rely on is its knowledge of the case, and it can rely on representations of counsel, right?
So,
we submit affidavits.
We should just affirm based on that we think the district court implicitly did the lodestar analysis, even though it didn't say
no. Pages 12 through 17 of the district court's decision is where the district court judge does the lodestar analysis. It looks at all the factors, it analyzes them, it looks at the evidence that we submitted, and it comes to a conclusion about what the reasonable value of attorney's fees are in this case. Some of the evidence that it looked at was, you know, obviously Exhibit A to my declaration, which is the itemized breakdown of all the attorney's fees. It also looked at my declaration, which analyzed the attorney's fees. And the court relied on that clearly and made its decision. And the attorney's fees that we're specifically talking about, it's true that nobody gave the court in writing the total of those time entries that TLM objected to. But TLM objected to specific time entries. I just added them up for the court, and it's the correct calculation. I don't think that it would be a basis to reverse the district court because it didn't do the arithmetic itself, especially when the arithmetic is right. This court can look at the math and just look at the time entries that TLM objected to on November 8th, 2018, at page 8 of its memorandum, and figure out district court didn't screw up, and I didn't screw up in my math. It's correct. I mean, what are we going to reverse the district court for and remand so that it can go do the math on those time entries? That would seem to be a waste, and I don't think that that's what's required under the applicable standard of review in this case, which is whether the district court's decision was clearly erroneous. It wasn't. It was right on the money.
The subject of the district court's decision and the application of the factors, I also have a different question. The district court, under the nature and difficulty of the responsibility assumed, says that the nature of this litigation over the course of nearly 7 years has been extensive, but it seems like that's improper in context. We're not talking about fees for 7 years. We're talking about fees for a period which I interpret to be something like May 3rd of 17 through February 2nd of 18.
It was May 2nd, 2017 through, I think it was...
Well, it's not 7 years anyway.
No, that's correct. It's not.
It looks like that is clearly erroneous.
Well, I think what the district court judge is saying in that sentence is that because this case has been going on for so long and it's going on in multiple different courts, it is very complicated anytime any task is performed in this court. And that's what we've seen in this case. And Mr. Chamberlain alluded to that during his oral argument, where they were dealing with a trustee in bankruptcy, asking the bankruptcy trustee to gobble up the wage judgments in this case as a set-off for the fraudulent transfer cases. All of those things implicate lots of attorney's time from my law firm in dealing with and protecting the wage judgments.
The district court wasn't talking about those fees because it held that those were not recoverable.
The district court filtered out and basically granted their objection and page 8 of their memorandum of law and excluded all of the fees that they objected to.
Right.
But that's part of our appeal is that
its analysis of the complexity could not have included what the district court itself said it wasn't considering.
I would beg to differ with you on that. The court's analysis was that this is a very complex case because of all the moving parts and all the different courts. Now, it said that the time entries that TLM objected to were from work that was performed in the bankruptcy case and it wasn't going to allow them, but it didn't say that means that this is a very simple case and this is a very straightforward issue. The fact of the matter is, because of all the intertwined lawsuits and TLM's attempts to collaterally gobble up the judgments that its two employees have against it, this was a very complicated case and required lots of time from our firm. All of that time is identified in Exhibit A to my declaration, and the district court applied the lodestar analysis, looked at all the factors, and determined that the attorney's fees were reasonable and should be affirmed on that basis. Now, I want to get into the issue of our appeal, which is that the district court, we believe, improperly excluded the appellate fees from the second round of appeals from its decision. And what this really breaks down to is the language in the applicable statute here, which is section 181.171, which identifies and provides the substantive right for Julek and Tomke to have attorney's fees added into their judgments in this case. And if you look at that statute, as we point out, it's very clear. It says the district court is the place where you can bring these claims and get your attorney's fees, and it's the district court is required to award attorney's fees. And then it refers to the court as the place to get the attorney's fees. Now, that's the definite article, the, right? It's not the indefinite article A. It doesn't say a court shall award attorney's fees. It says the court shall award attorney's fees. It's referring to the district court. The only court referred to in that entire statute, 181.171, is the district court. And that's why we applied for our appellate fees in the district court. And the Minnesota Supreme Court in the Hughes versus Sinclair marketing decision, which is 389 Northwest 2D 194, ruled that it's true the better practice is to apply for appellate fees in the appellate court, but it didn't say it's the exclusive practice and the exclusive way to get those attorney's fees. This court in the CO versus Doe case, which is a 2012 decision, it's unreported, but this court quoted that language from the Minnesota Supreme Court and said, again, it's the better practice to apply to the appellate court, but it's not the exclusive way.
Well, it seems to me those cases would contradict your view of the statute. You're saying that the court does not allow for what you've said now is the better practice.
Correct. The better practice is to come, and the reason I talk about the Hughes case and the CO case is just to show that this court and the Minnesota Supreme Court haven't exclusively relied on the language in the rule 139.06.
But aren't you acknowledging that don't those cases acknowledge a better practice?
Correct.
That you are saying is not allowable under your interpretation of the statute?
Correct. My interpretation
so
of the statute.
What should we do about those cases? I'm lost as to your argument. Are those cases wrong? Or should we disregard them?
No, those cases are not wrong. And
if they're correct, doesn't that dispose of your exclusivity argument about the court?
Well, it would say that the only court, I mean, your decision that we're asking for in this case is that the only court that can award attorney's fees under 181.171, including appellate attorney's fees, the only court that can do that is a district court. And what I'm citing those two cases for is for authority to not strictly apply Minnesota Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 139.06, which says you shall apply to the appellate court, okay?
Let me frame my question a different way. Reconcile the language of the statute that you're asking us to adopt with the better practice language in the two cases that you are asking us to depend upon.
Sure. The Hughes case and the CO case do not interpret Minnesota statute section 181.171. They're dealing with other statutes that have the indefinite article and say a court may award attorney's fees, okay? And so the Supreme Court and the Minnesota Court of Appeals have said the better practice is to go to the appellate court and ask for those attorney's fees. That's different. That's completely different from our case, which the exclusive authority to award attorney's fees is the district court. But again, those cases just show you that the Court of Appeals and the Minnesota Supreme Court don't strictly apply the language of the Minnesota Rule of Civil Appellate Procedure 139.06. That's the purpose of bringing up those cases.
While you were answering Judge Ross's question, I was able to pull up page 8 of the appellant's response to the motion fees on November 8th of 2018. Thank you for directing my attention to it. Appellant did not concede that everything except the bankruptcy court matters should be awarded or was reasonable or anything else. That language in that location says, similarly, numerous charges of other attorneys include work on bankruptcy court matters or the second lawsuit, the Hennepin County one, including the following, and then there's a long listing. None of the fees for work defending or settling the bankruptcy court bankruptcy adversary claims is recoverable in this court. Then it goes on. They obviously did not concede. If you read page 8 and page 9 and page 10 of that document, they don't concede that those other charges, the residual third category, were in connection with this lawsuit. They don't.
Right, but these are the specific time entries that they objected to, and then they just basically threw it up to the district court. I see my time is out. May I continue answering your question?
I have one more question.
And I agree that they don't concede that the rest of them are reasonable, but these are the specific time entries that they objected to. And they didn't produce any evidence to the district court to show that our time entries were not reasonable or that the amount of time that we spent was not reasonable. They didn't put in an affidavit with their own fees to compare them to ours to say, see, Dreyer's crazy. He asked for way too much in attorney's fees. Ours are way lower. They didn't do that. They didn't have an affidavit from an expert.
There's a declaration of Brian Kuhlman that attended that memorandum, which identifies that on one of the dates, as I read his affidavit, that there was a claim for a telephone call. There was no telephone call.
There were voice messages exchanged that day, and right, maybe there was no telephone call, but
There's a difference between a telephone conversation and a voice message, right, in terms of what the billing amount for that would be?
I don't believe so. I mean, if you leave a voice message for somebody, that's a telephone call with the other party. You've left it on their voicemail. And that's just simply a telephone conversation that happens, not necessarily with a person, but with their actual voicemail box. So I think splitting hairs pretty tight there. But if there's any other questions, happy to answer them.
Does that entry include the length of time?
That's what I'm looking for right now. I think I have it somewhere.
I believe it would, under Exhibit A.
We'll have to find it later.
If you have the date of that time entry?
October 9th of 2018, telephone conference with Ryan Kuhlman regarding satisfactions of judgment, blah, blah, blah. Oh, I think it might be 1.10. That was a long telephone message.
Yeah, there's other things included in that time entry. If you look at Exhibit A to my declaration, telephone conference with Ryan Kuhlman regarding satisfactions of judgment, review file documents, and research waiver of outstanding claims by satisfying judgment, draft revise update to client. So there were many other entries that happened, many other tasks that were performed at the same time.
And by conference, you mean voicemail?
Correct.
That's reasonable.
Yes. I mean, it's telephone conference with the person's phone number and their voicemail service.
It does also appear, can I have one more?
Yes, please.
I will quit. It does appear that the including language on page 8 makes no representation that that's all they're arguing about of fees that were incurred in the bankruptcy court. They don't say those were the fees were incurred in bankruptcy court to which we object and no others. It says that there were fees in bankruptcy court including, and then there's a list of examples. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, that's correct.
But so you really can't create the spreadsheet from that.
Well, no, I certainly did create the spreadsheet from these time entries because these are the ones they identified.
But it doesn't involve any concession by the appellant that those are the only fees that were in the bankruptcy court. It's just a list of some of the fees, including those.
That's correct, but our burden of proof is not to prove negatives. If they identify transactions that they object to, we can then address them. And the district court looked at that, excluded all the ones that they identified from the award of fees. We don't have to prove negatives. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. Counselor Pellant.
First of all, I think the key point in our argument was really not addressed by counsel. He said that there were two cases, Hauser and Kalar, where there was an application for fee following an appeal. We don't dispute that. We're saying that once you have it, though, you can't go back and have a second one. That's the idea. And you have to give up everything that could have been litigated, not just your claims, but ones that could have been done. And they didn't do that. And they didn't get touched by the argument. And I think that's dispositive because it is a final order and it isn't before the court. Second, counsel said that his interpretation was that 181.171 refers specifically to the district court and claims there's exclusive jurisdiction. I would direct the court's attention to subdivision 2, where it talks about or any other court of competent jurisdiction. And in subdivision 3, when it says the court, to say that the appellate court is not a court when it is, or the appellate court doesn't have any power to grant fees when I know it does, is not a valid argument. And it certainly isn't contradicted by the statute in any way. The other point is that on page 10 of the transcript, the court asked at the hearing on October 25, and by the way, there was the fees incurred in that just that 5-month period from May to October of 2017, but the court said, why didn't you ask the appellate court for the $39,000 fees you incurred to defend your attorney fee order?
What page that is
on page 10.
Thank you.
Mr. Dreyer said, well, in hindsight, I wish I would have. Well, of course, but that is not a good excuse saying I wish I would have and then go to the argument about exclusive jurisdiction, which I think doesn't apply, no authority, and to say this court doesn't have jurisdiction over fees on appeal when the Kalar case in the Supreme Court said that it only has the decision to make for fees on appeal. Exhibit A is referred to as though it is a breakdown of fees. It's a breakdown of time and charges, and it doesn't even tell you anything. In order to give a
valid... That's not fair. It does tell you some things.
Well, it doesn't give you any way to say, because we tried to do it. I mean, we were disputing it. To find out there's a spreadsheet that he's got in his office in court, that's what needed to be done, saying these are the items that are based on our claim. And I don't know how to do that even now. I do claim when there's a reference there to bankruptcy court, I know what that is saying. But to say, that we incurred $54,000 talking to the court twice, filing a garnishment summons, those are just ministerial things, and they were not anywhere near $54,000. And I think I'm seeing the reason. If it takes a voicemail of 1.1 hours, I get why it got to $54,000. I don't agree that it's right. And I think that there's a failure of proof, if they had to at all. We should never have been there. We got stuck for we lost $800,000, a small business in Minnesota, and then we get stuck for another.
Talking about the judgment that wasn't recovered.
Never paid, right. We never got it in the end. And then to say we had to pay $237,000 for that case, which we paid, and it's paid in full, and then to say, well, I want to come back again and ask for $100,000 or $54,000. Any amount in that is wrong. We had the fee hearing, and everything that occurred was before the hearing date. They could have said, I'd like to supplement my fee petition because I've got some more time here, Judge, so that when a judgment is entered, it includes all claims, not just the ones that you want to partially give, holding some back for a later date.
I've been out of the client billing role for over a dozen years. I don't recall at the time. We had voicemail even back in those days. I don't recall ever referring to a voicemail as a phone conference. What's your impression as to standard practice or whether this is consistent with standard practice in billing clients, referring to a voicemail message as a phone conference?
I can tell you this as someone who has never only practiced law, and mainly for Harley, it wouldn't even enter my mind to put it entry in for a voicemail that I receive. I've never done that. If I have a conference, that's different. But to listen to a voicemail, how long can it be? 60 seconds? I mean, this is absurd. To do that, I think, speaks volumes about the integrity.
Speaking of the characterization, is that whether...
Well, how do I characterize it?
Whether characterizing a voicemail, either listening to a voicemail message or delivering one, is characterized as a telephone conference.
I can't imagine calling that a telephone conference when it's not. I mean, it's exactly not what you did. If they said, listen to voicemail and leave a voicemail or something, maybe, but they never said anything of the kind.
I believe your time has expired, and thank you for your argument. Thank you for both counsel for your written submissions and your oral argument today. The matter is submitted, and we will issue our opinion within the statute.